everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHack. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now, let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a mostly sunny day today with the winds from the west and northwest at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Some patchy clouds tonight with the winds switching over to the southwest at 6 to 12 miles per hour and a little warmer tomorrow. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 47 degrees with a low of 28, mostly sunny. And on Thursday, a high of 61 with a low of 40, again, partly sunny and warmer. Turning to the front page of today's Des Moines Register, our main article, Baltimore Bridge Collapses After Strike. Also, Iowa Senate passes AEA teacher pay legislation. And Back to the Future, Parade and Juliet, coming to the Des Moines stage. And here to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. Iowa Senate passes AEA and teacher pay legislation. Iowa Republican lawmakers have reached a final deal to restructure funding to Iowa's area education agencies, raise teacher pay, and set school funding levels for the coming year, sending the wide-ranging bill to Governor Kim Reynolds. The final agreement on House File 2612 comes after months of negotiation between the House, Senate, and Governor. Reynolds first announced a plan to overhaul the AEAs during her Condition of the State address in January. But her initial bill met with widespread criticism, including from GOP lawmakers, causing House and Senate Republicans to write their own versions. The AEAs, currently the sole provider of special education services, would continue receiving 90% of the state funding that they currently receive, while school districts would control the remaining 10%. The legislation will give school districts control over all the state money for media and general education services that now goes to the AEAs, allowing them to spend the funding on private vendors or continue working with the AEAs under a fee-for-service model. Minimum pay for beginning teachers will increase to $50,000 per year, up from $33,500 under the bill, which also includes new state money for schools to raise experienced teachers' salaries and increase pay for non-salaried school staff. Quote, this bill, in its entirety, will not only improve student achievement in special education, it will not only help improve the AEA system, which is the support system for special ed and general education, but it's going to raise student achievement in its entirety in our state, said the bill's floor manager, Senator Lynn Evans, Republican from Orillia. Democrats, the AEAs, and other education groups oppose the changes. They say redirecting money that goes to the AEAs will make it difficult for the agencies to plan their budgets and could result in reductions in services and staff. Governor Reynolds and the Republican majority in the legislature are breaking our AEAs. Senator Molly Donahue, Democrat of Cedar Rapids, said in a statement, their changes turn AEAs into an unstable fee-for-service program that reduces access in rural Iowa and consolidates power in Des Moines. The bill passed the Senate on a 30-18 vote, with three Republicans, Senators Waylon Brown, Republican of Osage, Mike Klamisch, Republican of Spillville, and Charlie McClinock, Republican of Auburnett, joining every Democrat in opposition. The House passed the bill on March 21st. Reynolds released a statement following the vote, saying she looks forward to implementing the bill and thanking school administrators, school board members, and teachers for their input. Over the last several weeks, this bill has been the focus of much discussion and debate, she said. Change is seldom easy, but it is necessary to achieve better results. Reform in the AEA system creates accountability, transparency, consistency, and most importantly, better outcomes for all Iowa students. The legislation makes several changes to how the AEAs are funded and whether school districts must continue using the agencies for certain services. The AEAs are currently funded through a combination of state, federal, and local property tax dollars. They offer special education services to school districts, as well as media services and general education services. The bill does not make any changes to funding for special education in the 2024-25 school year. In the 2025-26 school year and beyond, districts would receive the state special education funding that currently goes to the AEAs, but they would be required to send 90% of that money to the AEAs while keeping the remaining 10% of funds. The AEAs currently receive about $185 million in special education funding from the state, according to an analysis of the bill by the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Federal special education funding would continue to go to the AEAs. In the 2024-25 school year, school districts would receive 60% of the state funding for media services and general education services, and AEAs would receive 40%. Schools could choose whether to continue contracting with the AEAs for those services under a fee-for-service model or use a private provider. Beginning the following year, school districts would receive all of the state funding for media and general education services and could choose whether to use the AEAs. The AEAs currently receive about $35.7 million for general education services and $32.3 million for media services, according to the bill analysis. The bill would authorize the Department of Education to create a Division of Special Education with 13 new staff members in Des Moines and another 40 who would be based within AEAs around the state. The bill also creates a task force to study and make recommendations on the AEA system. Pay for AEA administrators would not be allowed to exceed 125% of the average salary of the superintendents within their AEA region. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll conducted in late February found a majority of Iowans, 56%, have a favorable view of AEAs, while 24% view them unfavorably, and 20% are not sure. The legislation would raise minimum pay for beginning teachers to $47,500 in the coming school year and to $50,000 the next year, up from $33,500 under current law. It sets a minimum salary of $60,000 for teachers with at least 12 years of experience in the coming school year, before raising that minimum to $62,000 the next year. And the bill has $22 million for schools to use to raise experienced teacher pay, and another $14 million to increase pay for non-salaried school staff, like paraeducators. The bill would also increase state per-pupil aid to schools by 2.5%, an increase of $191 per pupil, bringing total state funding for public K-12 schools to $3.8 billion. The state is also expected to spend $179.2 million in the upcoming year on private school education savings accounts. The Iowa poll found 76% of Iowans favor raising minimum teacher pay to $50,000 per year, while 22% oppose an increase and 2% are not sure. McClintock was a lone Republican to speak against the AEA proposal on the Senate floor. He said he doesn't think Reynolds was wrong to call for a review of the AEAs, but said he believes the agencies would have been capable and willing to review themselves and make improvements without the need for the legislation. When this bill passes and the governor signs it, which she will do, our only reward will be the disappointment and anxiety of many AEA employees, teachers, parents, and students, he said. Senator Sarah Tron Garriott, Democrat of West Des Moines, said Republicans were desperately to attempt to pass something, anything, as soon as possible to please the governor. This isn't about what Iowans want. This has not been about what Iowans need. The purpose was never about making Iowa education better, and everyone in here and everyone out there knows it. Senator Sherry Lynn Westrich, Republican of Ottumwa, praised the bill, saying she thinks it will create more oversight and transparency in the AEA system. I think this is going to be great, and I'm in support of this bill, she said. Cindy Yellick, chief administrator of the Heartland AEA in central Iowa, told reporters following the Senate vote that it's going to be bumpy for a few years as the AEAs adjust to the changes in the bill. I can't really tell you what it's going to look like long term, she said. The timeline is short, the changes are significant, and as always, the AEAs will be focused on doing their very best to deliver supports and services to children and families and students and teachers and schools. Yellick said the debate over the bill has already caused AEA employees to leave their jobs. We have AEAs that have already experienced almost a 10% reduction in staff because of staff leaving, she said. We know that we're not in a prime position right now to replace these staff, just with the uncertainty of our future and what services will look like. Lawmakers' vote on the bill is sure to be a central issue in several contested legislative races this fall, and both political parties wasted little time in criticizing their opponents' positions. Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman quickly issued a statement slamming Democrats for voting against the teacher pay increase and saying they should be held accountable. Today's vote demonstrates that Senate Democrats prioritize education unions over teachers, Kaufman said. Despite the opportunity to raise starting teacher pay, they voted against it. It was an attack that Democrats saw coming. Senator Bill Dotzler, Democrat of Waterloo, criticized Republicans for putting several different proposals into the same bill rather than voting on teacher pay separately. The next election, we'll be able to say you voted against teacher salaries on House File 2612, and you won't be telling a lie, he said, because I'm going to vote against the whole bill, even though I support teacher salaries. That's what's wrong with doing this kind of thing. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart issued a statement saying Republicans will stop at nothing to score political points. By voting to weaken Iowa's area education agencies, Republicans have put their personal political agendas and their need to appease Governor Reynolds above the Iowans they represent, Hart said. It's time to vote for Democrats so we can create balance in the legislature and these partisan political power plays and make sure Iowans' voices are heard. Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, accused Republicans in a statement of dismantling the AEAs and chronic underfunding of public schools, which he said was made worse by the school choice legislation Reynolds signed into law last year. Do not be fooled by their claims of support, he said. Iowans are tired of empty promises and will remember this momentous mistake at the ballot box this fall.
Our next article from the front page of today's Des Moines Register, Back to the Future, Parade and Juliet coming to the Des Moines stage. Get your corn stalks and DeLoreans ready. Des Moines Performing Arts releases its 2024-25 season with a schedule of 5 musicals and 1 play in the package, along with 3 add-on shows considered some of the biggest hits on Broadway. All of the 6 shows in our package are brand new shows, says Jeff Cheslick, president and CEO at the Des Moines Performing Arts. Des Moines audiences will be among the first in the country to see these shows, and that's a great feather in our cap. Starting on March 26, season ticket holders may pick up seats for Back to the Future, the musical, Shucked, Life of Pi, Some Like It Hot, and Juliet and Parade. The add-ons include Santino Fontana performing with the Des Moines Symphony, Chicago, Hadestown, and 2-week engagement of Hamilton. This season also marks the 20th anniversary for the Willis Broadway series. Here's a look at the 2024-25 season, Back to the Future, the musical. You can fire up the DeLorean and go back to the future. Marty McFly, Doc Brown, and the DeLorean take audiences back to the future in Des Moines on October 15th through the 20th. The eccentric scientist takes Marty back to 1955, and the teen accidentally changes history. The team has to fix the present to change the past, get the DeLorean to 88 miles per hour, and travel back in time. We're getting it way ahead of time, said Chevslick, who first saw Back to the Future, the musical, in London. This is really unique in that this show is a current show from the current season on Broadway. So this is a rarity that will be going out on tour. It's still eligible for a Tony or Tony Awards for this season. Shucked, the Tony Award-winning musical comedy, makes a stop in Des Moines January 28th through February 2nd, 2025. The cornbread comedy takes place in the fictional Cobb County, where the corn sustains the community. When the corn starts to die, farm girl Maisie heads to Tampa for help. It's a bit corny, but audiences love it. Shucked is just plain fun, Chudzik says. I went into it having no expectations and cried laughing through the whole thing. Life of Pi. The Tony Award-winning play, Life of Pi, takes the stage at the Des Moines Civic Center February 25th through March 2nd, 2025. The play tells the story of Pi, a 16-year-old boy shipwrecked in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with a hyena, a zebra, an organton, and a Royal Bengal tiger. The production, told through puppetry for the animals, tells a tale of perseverance. The Des Moines Performing Arts helped finance this production as part of the Independent Presenters Network, a consortium of 40 leading Broadway presenters, theaters, and performing arts centers. Chudzik first saw this production in London. I just found this to be such a moving show, and I went in not knowing the story or the film. I went in cold and really, really enjoyed it a lot, he said. Some Like It Hot. The new musical, Some Like It Hot, earned 13 Tony Award nominations last year, the most of any production last season, and now the production heads to Des Moines, March 18th through the 23rd of 2025. Des Moines Performing Arts invested in the show based on the MGM film of the same name. The madcap caper of a musical set in Chicago during the Prohibition days tells the story of two musicians who flee the Windy City after witnessing a murder by gangsters. With the mob on their tails, they dress in drag and catch a cross-country train for life-changing trip. And Juliet. What happens if Juliet didn't take her own life after faking her death only to find Romeo dead when she reawakens? The Broadway musical, Anne Juliet, looks into just that, to give Juliet Capulet a second chance to fall in love in a jukebox musical pumped up with pop icons such as Since You've Been Gone, Roar, Baby One More Time, Larger Than Life, That's the Way It Is, and Can't Stop Feeling. The show, which Des Moines Performing Arts invested in, comes to Des Moines May 6th through the 11th of 2025. Parade. The revival of Parade comes to Des Moines July 29th through August 3rd, 2025. The production dramatizes the rape and murder of 13-year-old Mary Fagan in Georgia, the accusation of a Jewish factory manager, Leo Frank, her boss, as the culprit, and the 1913 trial that led to Frank's conviction. A group kidnaps Frank and lynches him. The revival of this production notes that Frank's case was reopened in 2019. I'm a big fan of Parade because of Jason Robert Brown, Jeff said, of the composer of Parade. We had a really great relationship with him as we opened his Bridges of Madison County tour a few years ago. Add-on packages available. Well, tickets can add on any or all of these three shows and a Des Moines Symphony production. It's hard to believe that this will be our third engagement of Hamilton when there are still cities that are getting it for the first time. And Hadestown was such a big hit. The coming season also marks the sixth visit by Chicago. Santino Fontana with the Des Moines Symphony. Tony Award winner Santino Fontana takes the stage on October 5th to perform at the Des Moines Civic Center for the first time. The evening includes fan-favorite songs combined with Fontana's stories about working with actors including James Earl Jones and Ryan Gosling. He appeared in Broadway shows including Tootsie, Hello Dolly, Act One, Cinderella, and The Importance of Being Earnest. Chicago. All Roxy Hart wants is to go from chorus girl to vaudeville star. When she's thrown in jail for killing her lover after he tries to end their affair, she gets a taste of fame as can only happen in Chicago. See it December 6th through the 8th. The show last visited Des Moines in 2018. Hadestown. Don't Look Back. Hadestown returns to Des Moines April 11th through the 13th of 2025 with its 8 Tony Awards in 2019. This musical combines the mythic tales of Orpheus and Eurydice and King Hades and his wife Persephone, all on a journey to the underworld and back. The show was so popular in 2022 that it's making a return visit. Hamilton makes its third stop in Des Moines, June 3rd through the 15th of 2025. The story of the birth of America told in a musical form takes the vantage point of founding father Alexander Hamilton with a score that brings together hip-hop with jazz and R&B. The show last made a stop in Des Moines in 2022. So where can I buy tickets? Well, you can visit DesMoinesPerformingArts.org. There's a free outdoor show. The Des Moines Performing Arts also announced 7 outdoor programs for 2024. All of the family-friendly events are free. The Secret Agency. The outdoor season kicks off with The Secret Agency, a story told by Secret Agent 23 Skidoo, a Grammy Award-winning, internationally touring, purple velvet tuxedo-wearing family. Shows take place May 16th and the 17th. Ants. Children can join in the fun as giant ants take over on June 12th through the 15th. The interactive performance gives kids a chance to explore the area around them from a new perspective. El Circo. Get to know Budinto, the lion, Aridina, the tightrope walker, Ursus, the weightlifter, a clown, a trapeze artist, and a circus band during El Circo, July 10th through the 13th. This big top thriller, presented through marionette puppets, includes Spanish language performances. Squonk Bruja. Music and audience participation are some of the calling cards of the Squad Accordion, a giant musical instrument which bellows and topped with tubas. Skunk Bruja, on August 19th through the 11th, gives the audience a chance to play this mega instrument. Storytime under the green umbrella. Head to Coles Commons on select Wednesdays and Saturdays from June through August for stories told under the Crusoe umbrella by Klaus Oldenburg. These events, aimed at toddlers, preschoolers, and early elementary-age children, include songs and stories. Yoga on Coles Commons. On the first Wednesday in June through August, head to Coles Commons for a free yoga workout surrounded by an estimated 12,000 perennials and the bustle of downtown Des Moines. Dancing on Coles Commons. Try Mixed Fit, a people-inspired fitness program that combines explosive dance moves with bodyweight toning. Class takes place on Coles Commons on June 30th and August 25th. So where do I find times and dates for the free shows? Well, for more information, including times and dates, you can visit DesMoinesPerformingArts.org.
And in our final front page story, Baltimore Bridge collapses after strike. A massive search effort was underway Tuesday for 6 construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore when it was struck by a large cargo vessel and collapsed into the Patapsco River, shutting down a critical artery for East Coast shipping. Around 1:30 a.m., a vessel leaving the port of Baltimore struck the Key Bridge, causing it to collapse in a matter of seconds. Officials say the crew warned of a power issue and sent out a mayday before the collision. Footage of the incident shows the ship smash into one of the columns before the bridge snapped, hit the water, and partially fell on the ship, where a burst of flames and smoke could be seen rising into the night sky. Several vehicles were on the bridge at the time of the impact and plunged into the river, which is measured Tuesday at 48 degrees Fahrenheit, cold enough to cause hypothermia. There were multiple contractors on the bridge who were repairing potholes, Maryland Transportation Secretary Paul Wadefeld said. So far, 2 people have been rescued. One was unharmed, and the other remains in very serious condition, he said. The University of Maryland Medical Center's Trauma Center treated one patient from the collapse who had been discharged, Michael Schwartzberg, the medical center's spokesperson said in an email. Schwartzberg declined to say more about the person's injuries, citing patient privacy concerns. Jennifer Homedy, chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, said at an afternoon news conference the agency will lead the investigation, but that she would not provide information on fatalities or injuries from the incident, leaving that to local authorities. As the priority beyond the search and rescue operation being conducted by the Coast Guard, she said, "Right now it's about people. It's about families and addressing the needs of those who were impacted. That's the focus." The ship's crew remained on the dolly, which needed to be assessed for damage before rescuers could board it, said James Wallace, chief of the Baltimore City Fire Department. The vessel was carrying cargo for major shipping company Maersk and was scheduled to arrive in Sri Lanka early next month. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said in a news conference the crew notified authorities of a power issue as it was traveling about 9 miles per hour. A senior U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly told USA Today the ship apparently lost power a few minutes before striking the bridge. A federal report has confirmed that version of events, saying the crew lost its ability to control the vessel. Moore said once the Mayday was issued, officials on site stopped cars from coming over the bridge. These people are heroes, he said. They saved lives last night. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott issued a state of emergency to better mobilize resources and work quickly to address this crisis, he said in a post on X. Moore declared a state of emergency earlier Tuesday and said he was working with an interagency team to quickly deploy federal resources from the Biden administration. President Joe Biden said he intends for the federal government to cover the entire cost to rebuild the Key Bridge, and he committed not to leave until the job gets done. We're with you. We're going to stay with you as long as it takes, Biden said Tuesday afternoon from the White House Roosevelt Room. Biden said he spoke with Moore and other local state and state officials about the bridge's collapse and said he would visit the site in the future. I told them we're going to send all federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency. I mean all federal resources, and we're going to rebuild that port together. Biden said 8 people remain unaccounted for, but the figure might change. Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident, Biden said, adding there's no reason to believe it was intentional. Our prayers are with everyone involved in this terrible accident and all the families, especially those waiting for news of their loved ones right now, Biden said. I know every minute in that circumstance feels like a lifetime. The container vessel was chartered by the major shipping company Maersk and was carrying its cargo, the company said. When it crashed into the bridge, no Maersk crew and personnel were on board the vessel, which is operated by charter vessel company Synergy Group and owned by Singapore-based Grace Ocean Pie, a PTE. We are horrified by what has happened in Baltimore, and our thoughts are with all of those affected, Maersk said in a statement. We are closely following the investigations conducted by authorities and Synergy, and we will do our utmost to keep our customers informed. U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Aaron Palmer said at a news conference Tuesday that the agencies remain focused on search and rescue. She did not comment on the crew of the ship or provide additional details about the collision. All vessel traffic in and out of the port of Baltimore was suspended until further notice, but the port remained still open for truck transports, Whitefield said. Traffic was being diverted from the area around the Key Bridge. The Francis Scott Key Bridge, named for the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, opened in 1977. It spans 1.6 miles, 4 lanes, and is the outermost of 3 major Patapsco River crossings in Baltimore Harbor, according to the American Civil Engineering Society. The Steel Arch Bridge was the second longest continuous truss bridge span in the world when it was built, and remains the second largest in the nation and 3rd in the world, according to the Society.
Turning over now to the Metro and Iowa section, our stories on the front page. Critics grill nominee for education chief. New mailers aim to give residents property tax info. It takes a village. Shift, the RegBry documentary, named the second best in category. And the RegBry icon, Mr. Porkchop Jr., has died. Bernard was second generation caterer for Ride. Critics grill nominee for education chief, Des Moines Public School superintendent among Snow's supporters. Governor Kim Reynolds' nominee to lead Iowa's education department faced questions Tuesday from advocates and a Democratic senator about her qualifications. 9 months after being appointed, Mackenzie Snow will go through Senate confirmation to hold the role of director permanently. Several advocates and members of the public voiced their opposition on Tuesday, while state education leaders and Senate Republicans endorsed Snow's confirmation at a subcommittee hearing. When I was nominated by Governor Reynolds to this position, I knew the department was facing challenges, Snow said. It was an agency reorienting its work after a global pandemic, navigating multiple leadership transitions across all levels of the department. Snow, who was hired last June, stepped into the role as Iowa's third education director within a year. She succeeded Chad Aldis, who suddenly resigned 4 months after replacing Ann Lebo for family reasons. She has taken the reins during a critical year for education policymaking in Iowa, overseeing the rollout of the state's new education savings account program and the implementation of a 2023 law taking books off shelves and restricting LGBTQ-related instruction. And in the last few months, Republican lawmakers have outlined plans to restructure the state's area education agencies that would grant her and the department increased authority over special education and other services across the state. Reynolds affirmed her support for Snow in a statement Tuesday after the hearing. Quote, Mackenzie Snow's experience and expertise as an education leader at the state level, U.S. Department of Education, and the White House has prepared her well to lead Iowa's Department of Education, Reynolds said. The work she is already leading with superintendents, teachers, families, and stakeholders across the state to transform education will have a lifelong impact on our students. These are the reasons I appointed her as director of the Department of Education, and I look forward to her confirmation and her continued exemplary service to Iowa students and schools, end quote. Critics say Snow lacks experience. Advocates who called for senators to oppose Snow's confirmation said her lack of experience in the classroom or in an administrative role disqualified her from Iowa's Holdings' top education job. Jessica Roman, who's been an Iowa educator for 20-plus years, said Snow would be unable with her qualifications to hold many jobs within Iowa districts. Someone with her level of education and years of experience would make around $55,000 a year at one of Iowa's larger public school districts, or an AEA, Roman said. Snow has previously worked at state education departments in Virginia and New Hampshire, as well as for a think tank founded by Republican Jeb Bush. She worked in the U.S. Department of Education under the Trump administration, spearheading a program that would have created tax credits for those who donate to organizations providing private school scholarships. She holds a bachelor's degree in political science and no advanced degrees and said she had taught at the University of the Free State in South Africa. Snow declined to directly answer questions about her qualifications from Senator Herman Kerbach, Democrat from Ames, deferring to her previous experience and policy writing experience. Quote, I think our teachers, our parents, our students in public education need to have a greater degree of confidence in the experience of our leaders in the Department of Education, end quote, Kurmbach said. Heather Sievers, founder of Advocates for Iowa's Children and a Democrat running for the House, expressed concern that potential changes to AEAs would mean Snow overseeing special education policy. She does not have experience in special education, Sievers said. She's going to have oversight of IEPs, curriculum. She's going to try to be in charge of closing achievement gaps. She doesn't have experience or a track record of success in doing that in other roles. But Snow is backed by Des Moines Public School superintendents and state leaders. Reynolds' office reiterated their support for Snow on Tuesday as the governor's appointee earned praise and backing from the Des Moines superintendent, president of the State Board of Education, and several other education leaders. Taryn Frieders, Reynolds' chief of staff, said of the three education directors she's worked with, neither rose to the level of Director Snow. She praised Snow as the, quote, CEO that Iowa's Department of Education needs, and said she was being judged by different criteria than past appointees to the position. Some members of this chamber are unfairly holding her to a different standard, Frieder said. Snow, during questioning about her qualifications, noted that Aldis, the previous director who was confirmed by the Senate, had not served in the classroom and did not have experience in executive leadership and state agency leadership. The superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools, Ian Roberts, praised Snow's visits to Des Moines Public Schools and said she anchored her discussions and conversations in data that is credible and reliable. I believe that the state of Iowa is in great hands by Director Snow, leading and being at the helm of our education policies, Roberts said. The two Republicans on the subcommittee, Senators Ken Rosenboom, Republican from Oskaloosa, and Jeff Taylor, Republican from Sioux Center, said they would support Snow's confirmation. It remains to be seen how Senate Democrats will approach Snow's confirmation. Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum told the Des Moines Register that as of Tuesday morning, the caucus had not yet had conversations about the process.
New mailers aimed at your residents' property tax information. A new tax document aimed at helping Iowans understand their property taxes and share information on coming budget meetings is landing in mailboxes across the state. The tax mailer is one of the several changes from House File 718, legislation passed in 2023, meant to keep soaring property tax assessments from turning into dramatically higher tax bills for homeowners. It also provides new tax breaks for military veterans and seniors. The law required them to be sent out by March 20th. Tom Nelson, a fiscal and policy analyst senior for the Iowa Department of Management, said the document is meant to help people understand and engage in the property tax process. Governor Kim Reynolds, Iowa Senator Jack Whitfer, and Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley issued a joint statement last May calling it a mechanism for property tax bill transparency. This spotlights taxes separate from any other piece of the budget, Nelson said. The two-page document shows property tax owners information on the amount of budgeted tax dollars and total tax rate in the current fiscal year, which began July 21, 2023, as well as a property tax proposed for the coming fiscal year for their school district, city, and county, according to the Iowa Department of Management. It also includes the dates, times, and locations of coming public meetings where each tax entity is now required under law to talk solely about their proposed property tax amount and levy rates. Nelson emphasized the document doesn't show the final tax rate for the coming budget year. It also doesn't include city information for rural residents. The new statement has been under scrutiny from some local leaders who say the statement could be confusing to property owners and local governments must bear the cost to send them. Polk County will pay about $100,000 to mail 146,000 statements to property owners, county officials told the Register. And with nearly 3 million properties that would receive the statements statewide, local governments are projected to spend more than $1.9 million annually to mail the document, according to the Legislative Services Agency. At a budget meeting in February, Polk County Budget Manager Deb Anderson said the statement could be overwhelming information for taxpayers. It's a significant event, expense, and it's stupid, Polk County Supervisor Angela Connolly said at the meeting. For more information, visit the Iowa Department of Management's website. And then another short article, dairy cattle in two states test positive for bird flu. Samples of milk collected from sick cattle in Kansas and Texas tested positive for avian flu, but the nation's milk supply is safe, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said on Monday. The detections in milk and a dairy cow show the wide reach of the virus, known as bird flu, which has been found in poultry flocks and mammals around the world. The USDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are investigating dairy cows in Kansas, Texas, and New Mexico with symptoms including decreased milk production and low appetite, the USDA said. So far, unpasteurized clinical samples of milk collected from two dairy farms in Kansas and one in Texas tested positive for highly pathogenic avian flu, the government said. A cattle swab test from another dairy in Texas also was positive. Based on findings from Texas, wild birds, which spread the virus globally, appear to have introduced the virus to cattle, the USDA said. Testing indicates the risk of human infection is low, according to the agency. The government said milk from sick cows is being diverted or destroyed, so it does not enter the food supply. Pasteurization is required for milk entering interstate commerce, a process that kills bacteria and other pathogens such as flu viruses, the USDA said. At this stage, there is no concern about the safety of the commercial milk supply or that this circumstance poses a risk to consumer health, the agency said. It added there should be no impact on prices for milk or other dairy products. In Iowa, the nation's top egg producer, avian influenza, spread primarily by wild geese, has prompted the destruction of millions of domesticated birds to prevent its spread, and there have been no reports of infecting other livestock. State Secretary of Agriculture urged industry partners, farmers, and veterinarians to report cattle illnesses quickly to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship at 515-281-5305. We are communicating with the USDA, other states, and industry stakeholders while we learn more and as there are new developments. Protecting Iowa's livestock farmers from foreign animal disease has been and will continue to be one of my top priorities as Secretary. U.S. dairy industry groups urged importers not to ban or restrict shipments of U.S. dairy products because of the detections. Importers have limited purchases of U.S. poultry since the nation's worst-ever outbreak of the disease began in chicken and turkey flocks in 2022.
It takes a village. Schiff, the Red Rye documentary named Second Best in Category. The Des Moines Register's Shift, the Reg Bry documentary, has been selected as one of the best documentaries of the year by the prestigious National Press Photographers Association. An internationally recognized industry group, the NPPA, promotes the highest standards in visual journalism, and its annual contest attracts tens of thousands of entries from both large-scale news networks such as CNN and storied publications with global reach like the New York Times. Shift placed second in the documentary long-form category, which recognizes in-depth works that explain complex issues with dramatic impact. Particular importance was given to documentaries with stellar photography or videography that elevates the presentation without distracting from the story, according to the association. The Register staff is thrilled to see Shift honored by the NPPA. Des Moines Register executive editor Carol Hunter said, "Our hope was to capture on film the spirit of Reg Bry and what it has become to mean to Iowa and Iowans. It's gratifying to see our staff's efforts recognized in this way. One thing we learned along the way is that it takes a village to make a documentary. Much of the credit goes to co-directors Courtney Crowder, the Register's Iowa columnist, and Kelsey Kremer, our former photo editor. They led a team that encompassed 10 Register staffers, 6 Register alumni, 7 other USA Today Network journalists, and 5 Reg Bry staffers who received credits on the film. And we benefited from great partners such as Iowa PBS, which helped with the final editing, and the Varsity Cinema in Des Moines, which hosted the premiere." The Photographers Association nod comes on the heels of Shift being selected as the opening feature for the esteemed Oneida Film Festival in Decorah, where the movie was also named the Walter Ordway Best of Fest winner in the documentary category, the highest distinction given to any nonfiction work in the festival. Using groundbreaking photography and intimate reviews, Shift explores the space, both literally and metaphorical, that Reg Bry offers writers and volunteers to sift through life's joys and challenges during a 400-plus-mile adventure through the heart of rural America. Shift also touches on some of today's most discussed social justice issues. While chronicling the main subject's hard-fought wins and devastating setbacks, audience members see them grappling with racial disparities in outdoor recreation, LGBTQ+ rights, opioids' effects on families, and difficulties faced by minorities in rural America. Shift was previously selected for the Iowa Independent Film Festival, the La Crosse Adventure Film Festival, the Cedar River Film Festival, and the Farm to Film Fest and Bicycle Film Fest. You can always own a copy of Shift, and DVDs remain on sale at regbry.com. The producers behind the film also are working to secure larger distributions, including a streaming option. We'll post updates on DesMoinesRegisters.com/regbrydocumentary as they are available. Shift, the Reg Bry documentary, was created with the belief that the film's message of personal achievement through bicycling would be strong enough to support its production. We are still seeking funds to cover the cost of making this movie. Please support our work by making a tax-deductible donation to Des Moines Film. Online donations may be made by visiting desmoinesfilm.org/shift-the-Reg Bry documentary. Checks made out to Des Moines Film with Shift Documentary in the memo line may be mailed to Des Moines Film at 1207 25th Street, Des Moines. You can learn about distribution or donations by emailing the Register. You want to host a screening? You can email regbrydoc@gannett.com with a link to your local theater and we'll reach out. Shift, produced by the Des Moines Register, is the result of more than a year-long project undertaken in recognition of the 5th anniversary of the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, better known as Reg Bry. It follows 3 riders making the 7-day cross-state journey in 2022, enjoying the camaraderie of the ride and the hospitality of Iowans as they tell their stories along the way. It also shares the anticipation of a couple preparing their small Mississippi River town to host the terminal Tire of Dip. Above all, it's a glimpse of how an improbable event dreamed up in 1973 by a pair of Register journalists has become a cherished institution drawing thousands of participants from around the world to rural Iowa annually. The ride, which is the world's oldest, largest, and longest recreational bicycle ride, will roll out of Iowa again this year on July 20th through the 27th. And in a related Reg Bry article, Ragbri icon, Mr. Porkchop Jr., has died. Bernard was second-generation caterer for the ride. The man behind longtime Ragbri icon, Mr. Porkchop, Matt Bernard, has died, his family announced Monday on Facebook. Bernard, aka Mr. Porkchop Jr., for many years drove the signature pink Mr. Porkchop bus along the route of Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, stopping each day along the way to grill and sell the cyclists' thick Iowa-cut chops and engage in salty banter with them. His father, Paul, the original Mr. Porkchop, started catering to Ragbri in 1983. When the elder Bernard retired after the 2007 ride, Matt Bernard, who had long worked with him, took over the business. Paul Bernard died at age 88 in 2016. Matt Bernard of Bancroft was in his late 50s when he died. In its posting on Mr. Porkchop Facebook site, the family did not give his exact age or the cause of his death on Sunday, and the business did not respond to requests for comment. It is with heavy hearts that we announce the passing of Matt Bernard, a.k.a. Mr. Porkchop Jr. Matt passed away peacefully on the morning of March 24th, surrounded by his closest loved ones. They wrote, adding, Matt truly loved Ragbri, the riders, and all those who make Ragbri the beautiful tradition that it is. They said they will announce the status of the business in connection with July's ride at a later date, as well as plans for a summer celebration of life for Bernard. Thank you for all your long-standing and continued support, they wrote. Paul Bernard, a retired farmer and longtime advocate of making good health, he called it soundness, a factor in judging hogs, became a mobile vendor on Ragbri after it passed through Bancroft and his stand selling pork chops there was a hit. He fell in love with a cycling community that embraced him as a carnivore king as he belted out his call of pork chop to greet the hungry riders who flocked to his roadside grills. His son shared a similar love for the ride and farming, joking last summer as he grilled chops for participants in the Ragbri Route inspection ride that even vegetarians eat his pork chops. NPR economics correspondent Scott Horsley is among the longtime Ragbri riders who swear by Mr. Porkchop's chops, and former champion bike racer Lance Armstrong stopped by when participating in the ride. Recalling his father, Bernard remembered him extolling the virtues of the cycling community. I never met a bad biker, he said, his father told him. They always clean up after themselves. They're good people. They take care of things. They take care of each other. Matt Phippen, a Ragbri rider director, said the ride community will mourn Bernard's pass as it did his father's. It's hard to sum up what Matt means to Ragbri, said Phippen. Seeing the smoke in the air and the pink bus in the distance and interacting with him every day on the route is something thousands of riders look forward to. It will be hard to fill the void he leaves, and we will miss him.
And turning to national and world news, justices mull limits on abortion drug. Supreme Court justices on Tuesday sounded skeptical that anti-abortion doctors have the ability to challenge the Food and Drug Administration's rules for a common abortion drug, raising the possibility that the court could dismiss a case that threatened to sharply limit access to mifepristone. 2 years after overturning Roe v. Wade, the justices were asked to consider whether to roll back FDA decisions loosening restrictions on how mifepristone could be prescribed and dispensed. Anti-abortion doctors are seeking to curb the availability of the drug that was used in nearly two-thirds of U.S. abortions last year, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. But justices on both sides of the court's ideological divide pressed for evidence that a physician had been forced to violate their conscience by treating a patient suffering from mifepristone side effects. Justice Neil Gorsuch said the case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action. Much of the nearly 2 hours of oral arguments focused on that issue, rather than on whether the FDA properly relaxed restrictions after the drug had been available for over two decades. The Supreme Court could dismiss the case outright if a majority of justices don't think the challengers have a legitimate basis to sue. Solicitor General Elizabeth Perlegar argued Tuesday that two doctors in the case don't have standing because they don't prescribe the drug, and religious freedom protections mean they wouldn't have to treat the rare patients who have an emergency reaction. Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch, all appointees of former President Donald Trump, probed whether the doctor's objections to the medication abortions could be solved by anti-abortion doctors simply asserting a conscious objection to certain treatments, rather than a sweeping judgment affecting nationwide access. Aaron M. Hawley, the attorney for the anti-abortion doctors challenging the mifepristone, said the existing conscious objection is not good enough because doctors may not know until they scrub in for an emergency whether the situation is a miscarriage, an ectopic pregnancy, or an elective abortion. By then, there's no time to object, she said. These are life-threatening situations. But justices repeatedly asked for evidence that such a situation has happened. A wide swath of government agencies and outside experts have said the drug, first approved in 2000, is safer than common drugs such as Tylenol and Viagra. Anti-abortion groups challenging mifepristone questioned those studies and argued that the FDA ignored contrary data. Perlegar argued the courts have no business second-guessing FDA experts about which drugs are safe. Moreover, she said, there are multiple ways any safety issue could be addressed. The FDA takes seriously its responsibility to ensure safety and conducts ongoing surveillance, making adjustments as needed, she said. The drug makers are also responsible at all times and can be sued for adverse reactions. So if the premise here is that unsafe drugs could somehow remain on the market, Perlegar said, I think that's incorrect. Hawley said adverse consequences connected to mifepristone abortions were more common than the other side claimed. Justice Samuel Alito questioned the mifepristone manufacturer's profit motive. If the court's restriction on the FDA is limited, Danko Laboratories is going to sell more, he said. Do you think the FDA is infallible? Jessica Ellsworth, a lawyer for Danko, said the drugs have certainly been withdrawn for after approval, which is why manufacturers continue tracking reactions to their products. Chief Justice John Roberts and Gorsuch raised concerns, as they have in other cases, about district courts issuing judgments that cover the entire country, as happened in the mifepristone case, rather than just their own geographic jurisdictions. Roberts asked why the case couldn't be limited to the people involved in one region rather than blocking the FDA from allowing the drug everywhere. I think it might be impracticable, Hawley said, because the FDA regulation would remain in place and permit things like mail-order abortions. In addition, she said, nationwide remedies are often needed so that everyone is treated the same. People began gathering Monday night for protests that sometimes became heated. Early Tuesday morning, calls by one protester that abortion is essential overlapped with chants by a Students for Life member saying, "We are the pro-life generation and we will abolish abortion." Ronald Quirk, 65, held a sign reading, "Supreme Tyranny." The father of a 24-year-old daughter, Quirk said he came from nearby Arlington, Virginia, because he feels the justices have made women second-class citizens. No U.S. citizen should have rights taken away, and that's what they did it last year with Dobbs, and now they're trying to do it again. And where's it going to stop, he said. As the legal arguments began inside, conflict escalated outside. Shame on you for what you do, one protester holding a sign reading anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-fascist, anti-abortion pills, shouted at an abortion rights demonstrator who held white plastic coat hangers stained with red paint. A group of demonstrators shouting, "Abortion is health care," attempted to drown out the opposing crowd. A block away, Capitol Police arrested almost a dozen members of the Women's March protest for civil disobedience.
Rubio could become Trump's vice president pick, but state of residence presents legal problem. Donald Trump's vice presidential list is ever-growing, but at least one prominent candidate has a special challenge. Marco Rubio, a senator from Trump's own home state of Florida. The U.S. Constitution and the rules of the Electoral College discourage running mates from the same state. That's actually why Dick Cheney changed his residency from Texas back to Wyoming in 2000 as George W. Bush made him the vice presidential nominee. Trump aide said he does not have a VP shortlist. He has a long list that is getting longer by the week. He also said he's not close to making a final announcement and may not do so before the opening of the Republican National Convention on July 15th. Rubio appears to be a serious contender for the VP nomination, though the again fanned speculation over the weekend when he said he'd be honored to do the job, despite once calling Trump a con artist. I think anyone who's offered the opportunity to serve this country as vice president should be honored by the opportunity to do it, even if you're a public service, Rubio said Sunday on ABC's This Week. Two Trump advisors, speaking on condition of anonymity, said Rubio is among many people being considered for running mate. As of now, two officials say Trump is more focused on the hush money criminal trial that he faces starting on April 15th than picking a running mate. Another priority is raising money, both for the campaign and for the massive civil judgments that have been entered against him. That said, Trump is getting lots of advice about his running mate from supporters of the various prospective candidates, including Rubio. As with other politicians, Trump has blown hot and cold on Rubio. He criticized the Florida senator for holding off an endorsement, but has been evasive as in his praise since Rubio actually did the deed right before the Iowa caucus. Trump aides are aware of the potential Electoral College problems with picking Rubio, but said they can be dealt with. Cheney is the most prominent example, they said. The Constitution doesn't prohibit a presidential ticket from having two people from the same state, but it makes it complicated. The 12th Amendment states that electors for each state vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom, at least, should not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. That means if Trump carries Florida, as expected, the state's 30 electors could vote for Trump or his running mate, but not both if they reside in Florida. Because of that provision, parties generally don't nominate candidates for president and vice president who are from the same state. University of Virginia's constitutional law professor John Harrison said in an email. There are a few ways that a campaign could try to work around the limits of the Constitution. Rubio could change his residency, as Cheney did in 2000. Simply switching your residency would probably be enough, but you can never know, said Florida Atlantic University political science professor Kevin Wagner, who noted such a move could face a court challenge. Harrison also speculated about a scenario where Florida electors vote for Trump as president and not Rubio as vice president, but noted that has serious drawbacks because Rubio might not get a majority of the Electoral College votes. In that case, the Senate would have to decide, and if the Senate is controlled by the other party, other than the party of the president-elect, it might choose as vice president someone from the party whose candidate for president lost the election, Harrison noted. Another potential solution would be to have Florida's electors be residents of another state, Harrison said, adding that's not sure if that would be possible under state law and the 12th Amendment. So while the Constitution doesn't require running mates to live in different states, it gives parties strong incentives not to go down that path. The constitutional questions aren't quieting Vice President chatter about Rubio, though, and he isn't doing anything to discourage it either. His behavior points toward him wanting the job. He's had plenty of opportunity to say he's not interested in the job, and he has chosen not to do so more than anyone else that he's done. That suggests, at the very least, he's considering the possibility, Wagner said. A Cuban-American, Rubio could help Trump appeal to Hispanic voters. He also may appeal to other GOP voters and leaders who are nervous about Trump. Rubio has been deeply engaged on foreign policy issues in the Senate. Rubio is also well considered in the establishment, especially among the foreign policy establishment. During a recent trip to the U.S.-Mexico border, Trump said he would consider Texas Governor Greg Abbott as a running mate, and he's considered a long shot. But Rubio is strongly critical of Trump when he ran against him in 2016. What we're dealing with, my friends, is a con artist. He is a con artist, Rubio said of Trump back then in a clip. First of all, he runs on this idea that he is fighting for the little guy, but he has spent his entire career sticking it to the little guy. Friends don't let friends vote for con artists, Rubio added in the 2016 clip.